Well, welcome back. This is our first episode of the Film Experience Podcast of the year. Yay!
Yay! I love that it's just like the year can finally begin now that the summer is over.
I know.
No time like September to start the year.
That's right. So I have with me Joe Reed.
Hey, what's up?
And Nick Davis.
Hello!
And I was trying to think of like a catchy title for this because we're going to talk about the summer. And the only thing I could think of was that I know what you saw this summer. Stupid like that. And then, but I was going to say, I know what
you are always thinking about Jennifer Love Hewitt. You just won't stop.
In Nick's case, I know that you finally started seeing movies again this summer.
Yeah, I think I figured out today that I saw 36 in August.
Yeah, you have been at a breakneck pace this last few weeks. It's been intimidating.
He had to make up for lost time.
Yeah, seriously. I love that I had like a 6 months head start on you, and you still like caught up to me at 50. I was just like, oh, I finally got to 50, and you were like, yep, yesterday.
That's the kind of, whatever. I have nothing to say to that. My life is empty.
Your life is full of fantastic movies. It's great.
Yeah, I mean, you guys, I just realized you guys both got me beat. Unless
that's
you,
impossible.
No, unless you count movies that are more than 2 years old in their home country that finally got released here.
I'm counting those. I'll count those. That's fine.
Because I don't count those because they confuse me too much. Because I like wrote about them 2 years ago, you know, that sort of thing. Like this Russian musical, Hipsters, and this and this New Zealand movie called Boy. And there's several that I saw at like Sundance like more than two years ago.
Wow.
That finally came out.
They're still trickling out. Wow. I actually just saw today a trailer for that Gael Garcia Bernal movie that I swear to God opened 2 years ago.
The Loneliest Planet?
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's actually really good.
Yeah, I want to see it. I'm mad that I missed it. It was at New York Film Festival last year, and I missed it.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, it'll be coming out eventually, Gael Garcia Bernal. And it's just like, nope, still not open yet.
I took one for the team and watched What's Wrong with Virginia the other day, which is like 2 years old and has mold all over it.
How is it? I heard
like Jennifer Connelly's career, but bump.
Oh, dear.
We're supposed to be podcasting in the name of love.
Yes.
But then I brought up What's Wrong with Virginia, so it's totally my fault. Yeah, it's totally bleak.
Yeah.
It's like a whole movie of deleted scenes.
Oh, and, God.
And, like, they're trying to do something kind of cool and weird and different, but it just doesn't make even a lick of sense.
Yeah, that's who else besides Jennifer's in it?
Well, Ed Harris, and when you buy Ed Harris, you also get Amy Madigan. That's still
of
a two-thing, so they're both there. And Emma Roberts. Who,
God,
and
how young was Emma Roberts in that?
Yeah, she was, like, 3. And some, like, teenage boys that I didn't recognize, but that doesn't necessarily mean anything. And Toby Jones, who's just kind of racking up the thankless parts.
Yeah, seriously.
Yes. But he's in, his roles are so small that he can do like 3 movies a month.
Yeah, totally. And like if you think he's ridiculous in them, you won't remember anyway.
Oh, Lucas Grabeel, of course, the guy from High School Musical and also Milk.
Was in the movie I saw?
Yeah.
I just said, I knew the actor. It just meant, oh, Milk.
And credited as Nervous Mormon, so.
Yeah, there are several of those if you keep scrolling. I don't really even know what that means, and I watched it.
I know what that means.
Who I really love.
I know what that means because I lived it.
Yeah.
You're like, been there, girl.
Well, I was hoping we could spend the first 5 minutes on that movie, so I've achieved my purposes here.
Excellent.
So I have to know, just because I just barely watched it, have both of you seen Compliance?
No.
I hated it.
Oh, it's at the top of my list. I haven't seen it yet, though.
I wanted to like it so much, and I just did not.
Yes.
Yeah, I've heard very, very, very polarizing things, which makes me want to see it all the more.
It just struck me as like a Michael Haneke wannabe that just didn't have the guts or something.
Yeah. I thought it was snide. Like,
yeah.
There's no. I mean, I read your piece, and everybody should go read what Nathaniel wrote about it. Okay, so have you done that now? Okay, everybody's read it now.
Wait, it was longer than that.
Well, you know, they can pause. Everybody knows how to. You guys pause. Okay. So now that you've read it, the whole thing about why did we ever leave the back of the restaurant makes a lot of sense to me. But then on the other hand, it's like you have to leave the restaurant a little and remind people, like, why everyone in America was so freaked out and terrified for those years. Like, and like.
Right.
Maybe would explain why people made decisions that you wouldn't always make, but without that, it's just about stupid people.
Yeah.
Well, this was kind of my issue with Alps, which is a movie I generally enjoyed. Have either of you two seen?
That's opening Alps? 2 weeks.
I have not seen that one.
Okay, but you both saw Dogtooth, yes?
Yes.
Which I really liked. And the thing with Alps was sort of the same thing where. Much like in Dogtooth, you have this sort of group of people who are behaving in this sort of hermetically sealed thing where nobody behaves quite normally and everybody's sort of accepting this reality that's not. Except in Dogtooth, it was sort of separated from the outside world. And in this, they're also interacting with the real world, except it makes no sense. Nothing, you know, nothing
oh, yeah.
from the world would touch it, even though it clearly is all the time. So That was my issue with Alps, in general.
The compliance being based on a true story is what flipped me out, because I thought, you know, even if it is completely true, it would have only worked for me if they had decided to go straight for allegory rather than, you know.
Yeah.
Because then otherwise you're just scratching your head the whole time, like, how can they not, you know, understand what's happening? But anyway.
Like, yeah, your supervisor's been on the other line the entire time, but you haven't heard anything from him in 7 hours. Yeah, he's not on the phone.
Right.
Number one. But my other favorite thing about this was that I was sitting in a Landmark theater full of Chicagoans sort of smugly clucking at the acquiescent people on the theater. And then, since this was actually still apparently being projected from celluloid, like in a museum, the image kind of went wonky, and suddenly, like, you know, the bottom half of the frame was on the top and you had like the big black bar in the middle, and everybody just sat there. Even though I was like 12 rows back, I was like, well, I guess I'll go. And
yeah.
So I walked out and looked at a bunch of people just sitting compliantly while the movie just failed to project in front of them. And then half an hour later, when it did the same thing again, they all just sat there and I screamed, don't worry, I'll do it again. And somebody said, we hoped you would. It's like, okay, well, this is actually seeming more plausible to me now. Nobody can even move their asses to do anything.
Yeah. Just let someone else take care of it for you.
What did you guys think of the last 20 minutes or so of Killer Joe? Because this is kind of this sort of dovetails with.
Listen, I am so ashamed that I missed that one, because I was like really excited to see it and I missed it.
Oh, okay.
I don't know what happened that week. I'm sure I have a good excuse, but at this point, I don't remember it.
Blame it on the Olympics. That's sort of that ate up so much of everybody's summer.
Yeah, you kind of sound like Romney, Nathaniel. I know I have an excuse, I just don't know what it is. It's really good.
But I stand by it, whatever it was.
Right, exactly.
Our sub-theme, Nervous Mormons.
That's right.
The Nervous Mormons, that's what this podcast is called.
Well, now you'll never be able to cut out that part.
I know what you saw this summer.
Yeah, right.
Nervous Mormons.
Since I had to watch all of William Friedkin movies in a row before that one to get this paper ready, like, I realized I was just watching it a lot of the movie in terms of like how it like did or did not do things he usually does. But that's impossible to do during that final sequence, which is so confronting.
No spoilers.
I'm not going to say, but I had read what Joe had said. Everybody pause. Okay, come back. About why isn't anybody talking about like the virulent misogyny of this. That's all we'll say.
You're quoting me absolutely correctly. And also the fact that I can't quite separate seeing the movie from the experience of seeing the movie.
Oh.
Because the audience that I was in, and I think this sort of like plays with the movie, was sort of laughing and cheering at things that really made me want to throw up.
Wow.
So, like, it was... Nathaniel, as soon as you see this movie, we have to talk again, because
okay.
I really want to, like... We'll have a good discussion.
I mean, the thing is, I really love Tracy Letts, and I like some of the actors. I don't, you know...
Bug was one of my favorite movies of that year that it came out. Like,
yeah.
I had really, really high hopes for it. And up until that last half hour, I was digging the movie hardcore, and it really, I soured on it really quickly.
It is, like, I mean, Tracy Letts is doing his, like, am I critiquing horrible perversion or just doing it as often? And, like, that sequence has a hard time with that. Although it did, it was, I admit I was totally compelled, even though I was sort of revulsed. Like, I couldn't make up my mind how I was reacting.
Yeah, no, I totally see that.
Without spoilers, can you tell me, is the final scene, is that why it's NC-17 or something?
Yes.
It's, yeah, I would think it would have to be.
The very first scene, I think, are the two. Because the very first scene has been written plenty of places, is Gina Gershon's character is introduced by a close-up shot of her vagina.
Oh, okay.
But that, I think, I think those bookend scenes would be the only reasons that I would think of why it's NC-17.
Yeah. I think, yeah, because isn't there even some, like, you know those awesome phrases where they say, rated R for some language, or whatever.
Yeah.
And whatever it says for Killer Joe is something like, for strange, violent, assault-type acts, or something.
And
I always love
and Gina Gershon's vagina.
Yeah,
yes.
Gina Gershon's bush.
Okay, I wanted to do summer report cards, but we're going to get more focused. So let's just get our best picture out of the way. What's the best movie you saw all summer, Joe?
Does Beasts of the Southern Wild count as a summer movie? I can't remember what
it does, yes.
Okay, because it's between that one and a very, very late entrant into the race, Hope Springs, to my great surprise. I absolutely adored Hope Springs. And thought it was so much better, A, than advertised, and B, than its genre would suggest it would be. I feel like we're all talked out on Beasts of the Southern Wild, or else I just want to pace myself because we're going to be talking about it a lot. Right? Which I think is great because I feel like that's a movie that should be talked about a lot. But the more magical realism parts took me a little bit longer to sort of orient myself towards. But overall, I thought it was really, really good, really strong. The music, I thought, was fantastic. The music I've been listening to all summer.
Yeah.
Like, so great. And I can't wait to find out how that's going to be deemed ineligible for the original score Oscar.
They'll find a way.
That's going to be a lot of fun to figure that out.
The music branch is already reeling from all these, you know, the changes they're making. Five original songs.
Five at least. those two. Beasts of the Southern Wild and then Hope Springs, which I thought dealt so much more seriously and honestly and compassionately with the central premise rather than played it, had laughs, but didn't play it for laughs, which I really, really loved.
But can we give a Razzie Award right now for worst music cues in any movie of the summer?
We absolutely can. It's brutal. It was brutally terrible.
It kept taking me out of the movie, which I was otherwise enjoying, but it was really like one of the most irritating soundtracks I've ever experienced.
Yeah.
It took me right to my Santino place of don't staple that to that.
Yeah.
You're doing great. Don't, no, God damn it. Don't show that to that. Like,
yeah.
But I was also, we're kind of completely on the same page. Like Beast of the Southern Wild is kind of a million years ahead of everything else that I saw that was new this summer. But Hope Springs was my favorite, probably. I mean, I'm sure it's the first thing I saw that I'm going to buy. It was like seeing the Loch Ness Monster or something. It was like, I didn't think we were allowed to do this, and just felt like, you know, such a great, I mean, for all the reasons you said, so I'm just like, I just co-sign everything you just said. And then just as a picture of it, it felt like a kind of Meryl Streep project of multi-years kind of bearing itself out that without her having made so much money with these other summer movies that have done really well, they never would have greenlighted that to not be slapsticky. And I mean, it almost seemed like another problem with the movie that if I was anybody except the three leads, there was like a Terrence Malick problem, right? Like it seemed like everyone surely had a bigger part, like Gene Smart and Elizabeth Shue. And even within their scenes, it seemed like huge things had gone missing, as though they realized how special the therapy sessions were and everything else had to get radically truncated. But
well, again, my director's cut with all of those scenes where Meryl and Elizabeth Shue talk shit about Susan Sarandon.
Right.
Will show up somewhere.
Again. Yeah, right.
I just want Susan Sarandon to do the audio commentary when the DVD comes
out. Ah, perfect. Perfect. I love it.
Because she could tell us a thing or two about sexuality and marriages, I'm sure.
And how much did you love the sort of fun contrast of styles between the way Meryl Streep acts and the way Tommy Lee Jones acts? Because I was sort of like watching the movie in the very beginning, it sort of struck me that like I don't think I've ever thought of Meryl Streep as a mannered actress, and she was, especially in the early going. And Tommy Lee Jones is so incredibly naturalistic and so incredibly sort of like, you know, your dad, you know?
Uh-huh.
And but I just love the movie really made that work for it because it was just like, you know, they just couldn't connect even on that level. And then her performance changed, and then his performance didn't change, but sort of like accepted her change. It was really, I don't know. I thought it was really, really strong.
I mean, I'm not as enthused as you guys. I was pleasantly surprised, but I wonder if it's getting, I wonder if a year from now, when we're past the, wow, that was not terrible as advertised, if people will be as enthused about it, you know?
Yeah, possible.
Like, because, you know, otherwise, I mean, it was the strongest contrast between what I expected and what I got.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
All summer. But my choice, you guys have two, like Beasts of the Southern Wild and Hope's Rings, and mine is Magic Mike, in addition to Beasts of the Southern Wild.
Yeah. It's been a really good summer for, you know, for non-summer-type movies.
Mm-hmm.
Because even Magic Mike, I mean, it's crowd pleasing in that way that male strippers can be. You know how they are. You know how they like to.
Because there's so many movies about that too.
Well, that's the thing. It's like there aren't. You know, it's such a mellow take on it. Mm-hmm. For as much as you know, the stripping scenes were really sort of rambunctious, but everything else was just. It's that real sort of Soderbergh downbeat. I could have spent the entire movie, and I may the next time I see it, just watching everything happening in the background rather than the foreground. All those scenes where like Matt Bomer and Adam Rodriguez are just like having a talk about skincare in the back.
Right.
I loved it. It was a lot of fun.
I mean, but can we thank Steven Soderbergh right now for being one of the few directors? And this makes me think of something that Nick, that you said about David O. Russell before, where one of the few directors who does not force you to look at any particular thing.
Yeah.
Like, here's a group of people and you can pick what you're going to take out of the scene.
So weird because I saw Haywire like the day of on DVD, and that movie not only does make you look at exactly, but there's literally no other reason to look. Well, there's kind of no reason to watch it anyway, but there's nothing else in the frame except whatever's in the center. So it was amazing to see that contrast.
Uh-huh. Yeah, sometimes I can't get a beat on Soderbergh at all, whether I like him even, but I thought Magic Mike was really great. Now let's move from our favorite movies to a scene that you love so much you thought your heart would burst.
Well, I know, unambiguously Summer. The scene in Sparkle where Carmen Ejogo, who's great in it, has brought her fiancé, her controversial fiancé, to lunch or dinner. I forget which it was. But
I think it's like Sunday.
The Sunday dinner, yeah.
It's Sunday dinner, right? Okay. So, and
great
this, like,
scene.
There's like 12 people at the table. You kind of assume this is going to be a, like, you know, just either comic or melodramatic expulsion scene. But like everyone, including the guy, has more to say than you think they will. The confrontation of sort of value systems around the table is really exciting and played earnestly. And that was, I thought, a great scene. And exactly what that kind of movie, which was doing fine at being what it was, really profits from just having one sequence that shakes everything up.
Yeah, that's another movie that was definitely a lot more than what, you know, you were bargaining for when you get the movie, when it was just sort of like, when it just seemed like it was going to be a Preacher's Wife style kind of thing. I really did love that scene. I was sort of longing for an actor a little bit better than Mike Epps to pull off his character. I thought he was kind of a weak link in that, but I thought everybody else, I thought the movie really profited a lot from being so much about the sisters' relationships.
Yeah, a lot.
And how it was really complex and really, like, it didn't really become the movie it was advertised to be until the last half hour. And that stuff is fine, and it's, you know, whatever.
My person that was taking me out of it, and I know it's, like, really expected, but Jordan Sparks...
I thought she held her own. I mean, she's not an actress.
And the parts of that movie that worked so well were real performance things.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, I just felt like she just was at a loss. But that dinner sequence is great.
I thought they managed that gap well by kind of even ending the movie at the plateau that she's able to reach. Like, you realize how many, like, murky waters have to be navigated to even have that concert.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but it's not like she takes over the world, you know.
That's right.
Like,
that's
it's true. Not Dreamgirls.
Right.
And I'm not positive that she would, especially. Well, whatever. We don't have to talk about the many flaws of Sparkle, but yeah.
Yeah. All right. Mine. I'm being me. I sort of narrowed it down to a few, but I can get through them quickly. The bumper car scenes in Take This Waltz, I thought, were really, really unexpectedly sweet. I'm just going to say Salma Hayek and Blake Lively having dinner in Savages made me laugh so much, so often. Salma Hayek, every bite of those lamb chops sort of spoke 100 volumes about everything.
And you don't mean that figuratively, you're actually talking about bites of lamb chop?
I mean actually, literally. Like, she devoured this thing.
Not scenery chewing.
No, she was doing that too, but she was also very literally, like, meticulously taking apart this little lamb chop in, like, the most, like, as she's doing that, she's also sort of picking apart Blake Lively's little, you know, hippie girl fantasy land. It's so, so, so great. I'm still going to be the one guy sticking up for Blake Lively playing unlikable characters in an unlikable way that's always perfect for the movie. Except for Green Lantern, whatever, that's not a movie.
Don't worry, nobody was thinking about the Green Lantern right then. No one is ever going to do that.
Thank God. And also the final half hour of Bachelorette, which made me laugh more than anything, has made me laugh all summer.
Yeah.
Just the energy of it, just how incredibly high energy it is, and then every once in a while you'll just sort of cut to Kirsten Dunst making the bitchiest bitch face. And it's so good! It's so fantastic. Like, I can't recommend that movie highly enough.
I freaking love Kirsten Dunst, as you both know. And
yes.
Wait, what?
And when Leslie, you know, cast her, I was just like, of course Leslie would find the proper use for her, you know?
Yeah.
Bachelorette special. And Nick, you haven't seen that yet, right?
I'm holding out for a theatrical, because I gather it's coming here.
I believe Friday it opens, right? Or maybe
I'm sorry?
It opens Friday, but does it open Friday?
I think not here yet,
okay.
but I'm not sure exactly. It's sometime in September, but especially now that I realize she was... I mean, I knew that you were friends with her, but I didn't realize she was Arden, who
mm-hmm.
all of us who were fighting about Moulin Rouge versus Lord of the Rings like 26 years ago on your website, like, she was like a great commenter, so it's going to be so fun to see her movie up on the screen.
Oh, wait, that was her?
Yes!
That's really funny. I had no idea about that. That's funny. Oh wow, old times. So, what was your scene or scenes?
I have to say, my favorite single scene of the summer is that chain of letters in Moonrise Kingdom.
Oh yeah.
Between.
That's really good. Yeah.
I found it was like the perfect match of a director's style and like sort of a whimsical flourish and sort of a plot propulsion. All at the same time, it just everything about that worked for me, and I just thought it was so funny and so endearing.
I don't remember it at all. What are you talking about?
Where they're remembering the letters they wrote to each other, which is how they basically fell in love, the two lead characters. And so they go through this huge series of letters, but they only ever tell you like one sentence. So it always cuts off before the actual thing that they're remembering.
Nope.
Wow.
Haven't got that movie was not a sticker arounder for me.
Oh, okay.
Not to bring the O word into things so early. But what do we think?
Oogie love. Is that the
yes,
word?
That is the word, in fact. When did that become a thing that all of a sudden everybody was talking
about?
That's
I think we can blame A.O. Scott because everybody loves his review so much.
Oh, Lord. Okay. But do we think that this this love for Moonrise Kingdom that was very unexpected for me, I guess. But do we think this has a shot at sticking around for maybe a 7th or 8th slot Best Picture?
I'm sorry, are we talking about Midnight in Paris right now? What movie?
Well, that's kind of what I'm thinking about. Is sort of it. I feel the same kind of vibe where sort of the love for the director's overall output is sort of all being funneled into this one movie, and it worked for Midnight in Paris certainly last year. It's a different.
My hesitation with thinking about the Big O in terms of Moonrise Kingdom is that, you know, in addition to Wes Anderson being an acquired taste that they have not yet acquired, I think it will also have the problem that it's about kids, and it's not about cute kids the way the foreign film winners can sometimes be.
It's no Kolya.
Right.
Yes. I love you guys.
I know. Come to the Film Experience podcast for your up-to-date, cutting-edge jokes about Kolya. Still got it, you guys.
Just as a plug, if it's still playing near anybody who's listening, I just saw Red Hook Summer, the Spike Lee movie that made everybody either mad or yell or be crazy at Sundance, which is similarly like a distillation of the kind of movie he makes. And it stars two kids who are similarly, I would say, awkward in the way they're forced to kind of hold the camera through the whole thing.
Right.
And there's this kind of weird congeries of adults around them who are more or less more recognizable to you than they are. And it's such an interest. I think that would be an amazing double feature of like all the things that are different about those two filmmakers are obviously incredibly different, but it is kind of a case of, I can see why his movies had trouble sort of landing, although there's a big performance in it that if it were being released by a different distributor than Variance Films might be getting some pretty intense Oscar play. I know. but if you liked Moonrise Kingdom and you want to see, it's almost like a Five Obstructions, like giving a totally different filmmaker two blank slate kids and some interesting grown-ups to work with and then see what happens. But
nice.
It's one of many, many movies, and Take This Waltz, which came up before, is another one for me that, like, for me this summer is so much about the movies that I reacted to really, really variously, like, within the movie. Like, hating parts of it and really being interested in parts of it. And there were a lot of, like, risky movies that were doing something that was hard to know how to feel about. So I'm happy about that, even though I liked a lot of them more than I liked others. But
Take This Waltz was the rare movie where I sort of walked away from it being like, I don't know that this is a great story. I don't know that these are great characters. But I really love the direction of it, which I feel like is always backwards to a thing where, like, the directing is sort of part and parcel to how much I love a movie. But in this one, I feel like I loved the directing choices that Sarah Polley made almost more than the movie itself.
I find it interesting that, you know, we've been talking for over half an hour already, and we haven't mentioned any movie that was a massive blockbuster.
Us? I'm shocked at us.
I probably didn't see it. I saw Batman, and I think that might be the only... Well, how many huge hits were there this summer?
A lot. I mean, there was Brave, there was The Avengers, there was Spider-Man, there was Dark Knight Rises. What else? Snow White and the Huntsman.
So of those, I saw Batman.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I saw The Dark Knight Doth Rise, or whatever. Right. I took it very seriously, and I watched it very seriously, while folding my armrest up and being like, this will be easier if I get two seats. I'm just going to lie down for this grim experience. By all means, move at a glacial pace, Christopher Nolan. You know how that thrills me.
So speaking of thrills, I want to know who your major summer crushes were at the movies.
All right, once again, I have a list.
Oh, you have a list.
I know we're all shocked. I couldn't just leave it at Channing Tatum because that's the most obvious thing ever. And I've had a crush on Channing Tatum forever. And this is nothing new. Magic Mike sort of honed it, but like that was there. And similarly, I've had a thing for Aaron Johnson for like the last couple of years. But honestly, he's so appealing in Savages in so very wrong ways, where it's just like, he's a drug dealer, but oh, he's an herbal, he's a botanist, really. He's really not even, like, that much into the drugs. He's really about the, you know, the botany of it and the science of it, and he just wants to make people's lives better and play soccer with kids in Africa, and it's just really, really fine, and he's really nice. And he seems like a very concerned, you know, he's a tender and giving lover. From his sex scene in the movie. I'm just going to say, like, we learn a lot of things about Aaron Johnson and Savages.
That was amazing.
I was going to say, every time Joe talks about Savages, because this is not the first time I've heard it.
Won't be the last.
I think it makes me never want to see the movie, because it could not possibly be better than all of Joe's rants and raves about that movie.
I really had a good time. Finally, again, something I just saw this weekend, the foursome of Ari Grainer, Lauren Miller, Justin Long, and Mark Webber in For a Good Time Call. All four of them so appealing, so attractive, so wonderful. Really, really love the four of them. So,
listen, I just found out, I don't know how this escaped my attention, but I just found out that the director of that movie is Jamie Travis, who I am just in love with. And I was just like, what? He made all these amazing short films, like the Patterns trilogy and names are escaping me right now. The Saddest Boy in the World. Like, his short films are so great that now I'm like, why didn't I know that he had made this feature?
It's a really good movie. I recommend it to any and all people.
I would just say my major summer crush, also totally expected. I can't help it. David Eight in Prometheus. I just...
Oh, Michael Fassbender. Oh,
yes.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
I know he's an android, but, you know, and I know he's not technically an android like Gigolo Joe in AI, but to me, he's like a love android.
You're like, I can program him differently. There are ways to work this. It's fine.
Yeah, I loved every moment he was on screen. It made me not care about any loose end in the movie or all the other things people complained about.
You're like, what? What things? I don't understand.
I thought it was a 2-hour documentary about Michael Fassbender's face while playing an alien or an android.
So I have weird feelings about that, because now Shame and Prometheus, I just sort of sat in front of Michael Fassbender and remained uninterested in him twice. And I don't know what has gone so wrong in our relationship. I felt a little like, don't turn out like Edward Norton, who I remember as a crush of my youth. And now when he shows up in movies, I go, do we have to do this? Do we absolutely have to be confronted with this? Is he thinking about anyone except himself in this scene? I think he's not. I don't know. I think he's not. So that's those are my anti-crushes. Edward Norton. Right? Yeah.
So, yeah, we're diametrically opposed on this one.
Oh, are you really into Edward Norton's resurgence?
No, about Michael Fassbender.
Oh, yeah.
I actually thought Edward Norton was really good in Moonrise Kingdom, though. To speak of two things.
I did, too. I did, too.
I thought he handled...
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, there are actors who really fit well with the Wes Anderson dialogue style, and there are ones who sort of power through it and are fine anyway, like Francis McDormand was. But I thought Edward Norton sort of slipped into that style very, very well, and I
felt like he was thinking about what would an actor in a Wes Anderson movie do. Maybe I'll have a funny walk. Maybe I'll say this in a slightly twee way. Like, I was way more about Bruce Willis in that movie, who I think is super good at just kind of doing his Bruce-ness, but it always, like,
Bruce,
with Terry Gilliam, with Tarantino,
yeah, Bruce
with
is good. Bruce is good at adapting himself as himself to any style. I don't know how he does it.
Yeah.
But he's great.
And that was the narrative thread that kind of got me through the movie, I think. Which I liked. I liked the movie fine, even though I don't remember it very well. But
can we at least agree that Tilda Swinton was brilliantly named in that movie?
Yeah.
Oh, at Social Services?
Yes.
Like she should really just stop having human names in movies anyway, right? She's basically, she's a concept anyway, so why not just start naming her?
Speaking of concepts, my other true crushes, I have to say, I cannot stop thinking about Juliette Binoche and Samantha Morton in Cosmopolis.
I really loved Samantha Morton in Cosmopolis. I was really angry at how little of Juliette Binoche we got in Cosmopolis, that I was sort of like, oh, we get Juliette Binoche, but we get her sort of objectified and so briefly and whatever. I thought Samantha Morton was the one scene in that movie where I was completely... I thought she plugged into the ridiculous talkiness of it and the ridiculous obvious symbolism of it in a way that it worked for like a good 10 minutes and then she went away and then the whole thing went away again. So
yeah. Nick, did we hear your precious?
Well, I think it's Steve Carell in Hope Springs. So it would just take us back where we have been. But I have, you know, in the Adams, like, Dude Dumper Mary world, like, Steve Carell has been my Mary answer for a long time. Just, it doesn't matter who else we're talking about. And so, yeah, to hear, like, I thought he was great, and I think he's being so interesting in movies right now, and without really seeming to do all that much, but just, like, in Crazy Stupid Love, I thought he was so, like, how do you sit opposite Meryl Streep and not get lured into acting, you know?
Yeah.
Or to being naturalistic the way Tommy Lee Jones was, because he wasn't doing that either.
Right.
So the degree of self-effacement was incredible, but I totally believed that he would, like, the generosity of spirit in that character really came through, and so yeah, it's him.
Well, and I feel like there's a way to view that role, especially I would think on the page, as being thankless, so why am I even going to bother? Like, this is going to be
Marilyn
and Tommy show, so why even show up? You know, somebody of his sort of caliber,
Thatcher,
where he sort of sits, where he sort of sits in the food chain, that his time, another actor might have thought, well, my time will be better spent in something that might not be as good, but it'll give me, you know, more of a profile. Sat in the pocket there and did what he had to do in a really, really very, you know, nice way, but again, not showy, not flourishy, not competitive.
Yeah. And I guess my other answer, and I have Nathaniel to thank for this because I wasn't even going to go see the movie, was every lesbian or maybe lesbian in Farewell My Queen, and all of the longing and staring and desiring that was going on in that movie was great.
I just missed it in the theaters. It, like, I was like ready to go. I'm finally going to go see it. And then it's like, nope, gone.
Oh, it was really good.
It's really good.
Very pleasantly surprised by it.
And it was better than I thought it would be. It was, like, better at the sexuality than I thought it would be. I thought Lea Seydoux and Diane Kruger, who have not sort of leapt out at me in other movies exactly, I thought were terrific in this.
I mean, Lea Seydoux just amazed me.
Yeah.
Like, there was just so much you could, like, sort of project onto her character based on what she was doing.
And I know there is, like, an equal number of people who are really frustrated with that aspect of the performance in that movie, but I was totally taken with it, just like I knew you had been. So I'm so glad you made me go see it.
Yeah.
And I think Virginie Ledoyen is maybe, like, a sort of standout weak link in that movie. And it was amazing to me that with the object of desire that both those actors had to play off of being so flat and like you mentioned, costumed so weirdly badly. Like that was just a big weird whiff in the middle of the film, but it didn't sort of seem to hold them back very much.
I did ask one question, what did you actually learn at the movies that you didn't know before? And I don't have an answer for this one, but I just thought it would be an interesting question.
I learned that the Bourne franchise can totally keep going without Matt Damon. Does
that
count?
No, that's totally, so long as you stuff enough actors into a movie like that, like, absolutely. Just, like,
make it look good as hell and move really fast. And that was my, when you said before Hope Springs was the biggest gap of what I thought I was getting, or maybe you said it, Nathaniel. I would put the Bourne Legacy there also. I thought it was great self-acquittal. I know that's not really an answer to your question.
I can say that I learned that Emily Blunt has the best chemistry with anybody on the screen in any movie that she's in at any time. I feel like she's really, she's really, like, working at a higher plane of just, like, clicking with other people. I thought she and Rosemary DeWitt and Your Sister's Sister were such great sisters.
Yeah, like, but I would, so, can we just give, I mean, Rosemary DeWitt, I know she's being typecast in this part.
Well, yeah, she's America's favorite sister at this point. Like,
but,
she's so great.
And I think there's a reason, because she's so terrific at connecting to other actresses.
Yeah, I think the both of them. But I also think of, like, Emily Blunt in The Five-Year Engagement and, like, really selling this kind of goofy, fun chemistry with Jason Segel that isn't always the easiest to do. And it's just, like, when I'm sort of the cynical asshole being like, somebody who looks like Emily Blunt wouldn't be with somebody who looks like Jason Segel.
Is there a particular line reading that stuck in your head this year? Or this summer?
I tried to find something specific from Bachelorette because really there are so many of them. And I kind of settled on, I can't remember the actress's name who plays Adam Scott's mother. But when he and Lizzie Caplan show up at her house at like 4 a.m. or whatever, and she just looks at Lizzie Caplan and she's just like, I'll get you some pants. it was so good. That one and Ari Grainer finds occasion to use the word vag bags for a good time call. And it made me laugh so very much.
To be continued in part 2.